Hello, and welcome to a brand new episode of Databook, a Chief Healthcare Executive podcast. My name is Skylar Jeremias, and I'm an assistant editor at CHE. Today, I will be joined by Matthew McKella, President and CEO of Life Image. We discussed Life Image's recent survey on whether providers have put measures in place to reduce information blocking in compliance with the new rules that went into effect April 5th, 2021, from the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT, also known as ONC. We also talked about how the COVID-19 pandemic has influenced the adoption of such measures. To start us off, could you just summarize what the new ONC rules entail and how they impact providers and consumers?
Sure. So the ONC rules, right, principally, right? And this is what they call the Cures Final or Cures Act, right? Which has been kind of finalized, you know, basically sets out rules that increase patients' access to their medical data and also create technology standards that all kind of healthcare technology companies have to comply with so that data can be more accessible in order to drive healthcare innovation and drive healthcare competition here. Because healthcare data itself, right, I think what all of us in the space, you know, recognize here is really the blood of healthcare, so to speak. Without the data, you can't diagnose someone. Without the data, you can't develop research. Without the data, you can't develop software programs that do things to make care more appropriate. You can't develop machines to take better imaging. You can't develop machines that do blood analysis more appropriately. You have to have the data. And healthcare data historically been incredibly difficult to access because every healthcare technology organization, right, has historically used its own ways of providing access to data. In many cases, right, they're blocking that data because it has commercial value to them and they don't want to, you know, give that data out to other organizations. And so data in healthcare lives in these silos, which slows everything down, frankly, creates patient harm, and makes everything far more expensive. And so the ONC principally has stepped forward and has to enforce some rules, right, passed by supported by legislation in Congress that basically says, hey, guys, stop the shenanigans here. You've got to make data accessible. And so we're going to, you know, create some rules and then enforcement behind it that say you need to standardize the way that data moves and you have to provide that data to third parties and to patients without added cost, complexity, or delay. And so that's the kind of at a 30,000 foot level what, you know, the rules are about.
What happens when healthcare organizations fail to make changes or comply with the new ONC rules?
Well, what will happen here is there are financial penalties involved here, which can be quite substantial. They could run into, since they are, you know, typically measured by incident, which is, hey, I didn't give this one single patient the data in compliance with the rules. I've determined that that is not a single patient, but a, you know, compliance factor against a large population, right? That fine could be multiplied, you know, by number of patients, which in many cases could be tens and 10,000s of occurrences. And each one of those things can be hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars, right? So the financial consequence of non-compliance here can be crushing, right? It could be the end of your institution in many cases, or the end of your organization if you're found to be, you know, non-compliant. And so there's a lot of discretion ultimately that ONC can apply, but these could be very substantial financial, you know, penalties. The ONC has been, you know, I think fairly gracious this year in the sense that the requirements around, you know, provisioning of data and information blocking, they have not let up on the timetable to deploy the solutions, but they have basically said, we're going to let up on compliance here because we recognize in a pandemic experience and year, technical projects to meet these compliance rules may not be your first priority. So keep moving forward, and then we're going to, at some future date, turn that enforcement on. And that just happened this month. In the month of April, the ONC has come forward and said, yes, we're not going to delay this any further. You need to now be in compliance. Otherwise, you suffer, right, the risk of consequence here, which is, it's pretty substantial financially, as I mentioned, but it could lead all the way up to closing your institution here also. So it's serious stuff.
Could you briefly explain some of the findings from Life Image's preparedness survey?
Sure. So given that Life Image's business is interoperability, right? We've always enforced publicly available standards. We've always used those. We don't build proprietary standards, I mean, to prevent data from moving. We're the ones that have to work with organizations and software that is not interoperable in order to facilitate it. So having kind of said that here, it's a deep area of concern for us. And so earlier this year, here we conducted a survey. It was about 4,000 participants in the provider world, right? Now, we didn't survey the compliance folks, right? Specifically, we didn't survey the heads of kind of technology, right? That are very likely, right, and should be, highly informed about what's going on and move this forward. But it's generally the folks that sit in the middle part of the organization, the folks that day-to-day make the work, the directors, the ones that run these IT projects, the folks that are running these initiatives, right? Not the corporate folks that are talking outside, but the folks inside the facilities and system, right, that are actually doing kind of the work. And so we surveyed about 4,000 of those, right? And some of the key highlights, right, that we found, we had a series of questions around digitization, right? Do you, since these rules require the digital transfer of data in a standard way, how many are transferring digital data now? What's your kind of baseline? And we're literally talking just, just within the last, 2 months. And so in the survey, what we found was that still fully two-thirds of all organizations were still using paper, right, as their primary form of moving medical information around. Right. So when you recognize that compliance is for digital transfer and you have such a large part of the, kind of system of people who are doing the work and providing the records, still doing it in paper, right? That's a bit of a red flag, right? We found that for imaging, right, more than a third, right, of those institutions were still, as a default, using CDs, right, which isn't digital transfer, right? For medical imaging as their default and primary, right? So a full third of the system, right, hasn't digitized something that has been digitizable, right, for the better part of a decade and a half. We found that roughly 40% of all institutions were requiring patients to physically come into the facility in order to, acquire their records and physically pick them up, right? Obviously not digital. Obviously not best practice in COVID years where period where you want less people coming in to pick up physical records and moving things around and touching them. We also found that of these institutions, about two-thirds of them or so did have portals. They did have EHRs, they had ways of transferring data to patients, but the utilization of those portals to transfer data is incredibly small. We found that to be about 13%. So we've made all of these investments in EHRs over this past two plus decades here with untold billions of dollars here. And still we're not at the place, right, where those portals are tremendously effective, right, for exchanging information in a way that patients ultimately, use them. When we focus specifically on the ONC rules, right, and the requirements, right, to prevent, information blocking, what we found were that in the middle part of these organizations, right, where folks, and again, this vice president, director level people who are very knowledgeable and should know what's going on a day-to-day basis, that, roughly 50% of them said, we haven't really made any changes relative to our practices or our technology, for to meet ONC requirements here at all, right? Which is an incredibly large number, right? Very different than sometimes what these institutions are saying publicly to what's going on kind of today here. We found that when we asked the question of this group, 47%, right, said, we don't even know what information, blocking is, right? That's a term that we, haven't, heard before, right? And that's, a core part of this overall, rule set, right, is that organizations can't block that, right? And when we talk about what information, blocking here, it's a fairly broad kind of definition, but basically the ONC considers it to be, any practice, right, that interferes with access or exchange for, electronic health, information here. And so, when they think about that, right, they say, well, what would be an interference? It would be when an organization, you know, delays in getting a patient there, you know, EHI here, you know, in any way that isn't an exception, isn't because it's going to harm them or there's a privacy issue. But basically, patients can come and say, hey, I have a digital way for you to give me my data. Here's an app, right? Here's a way to do it. Here's a portal. You need to give it to me in this form. And the institutions are basically, or I get penalized, right? They're blocking that data. And, you know, roughly almost half the organization said, we don't even understand this concept. You know, our understanding is we have policies, procedures inside our institution about giving data. We restrict it, you know, pretty seriously here. What do you mean, right? We're blocking data, and then that may be a, you know, compliance issue. So that was really kind of pretty unfortunate to have discovered just right as these rules start to become and compliance rules start to come in effect. We had roughly 30, we're not roughly exactly, right? 39% of the surveys did understand there were financial penalties involved, right? With not complying, you know, with these rules here. And, you know, 15-ish% or so were still in a position that said, yeah, we're still charging patients for records, right? $25, $30, $40, $50 for their records, which is expressly forbidden, right? By the ONC, these records have to be provided for free to patients. They have to be provided in, you know, the format that they ask for using the technology that they are, you know, requesting you to send it to them in. You can't say to them, you know, no, I just won't do it, or my policies don't allow, or my guidelines don't, or my supervisor won't, or you have to pay for it, or you have to come in, or you have to sign 200 consent forms. That's information blocking, right? And that's not allowed. So those were the survey results we found. You know, so a bit unfortunate. This was in both large and small institutions. So this was not, you know, small institutions that didn't have capacity. We're dealing with very large tertiary care centers, academic medical centers, folks that are organizations that are big and complicated and spend a lot of money on this. But, you know, it is clearly suggestive, right, that there's a significant educational effort that still needs to go on inside the provider community about what this is, you know, below the C-suite here, and what they need to do so that they don't footfault this and put their institutions at risk.
How has the COVID-19 pandemic influenced the speed of organizations adopting interoperability initiatives?
So I think what COVID-19 and what the pandemic has done is I think it exposed pretty dramatically exactly how poor the state of interoperability is for medical information, you know, in the United States, right? When the pandemic hit, and now patients, in most cases, right, where they were isolated, they were sent to institutions that might not be there, one that they normally received care, certainly not their doctor's office. They were in an ICU somewhere, right? And they were generally centralized and contained, right? Patients that pushed into those facilities, we found early in the pandemic, and CDC did a survey on this, which is less than 6% of those patients that showed up in the ICUs for treatment for COVID-19 had access to prior medical records. Now, when you think about that, right, you're talking about folks that are afflicted with, you know, with a incredibly, right, dangerous respiratory illness at the time, of which there's very little treatment known and protocols for, that we know affects not just your lungs, respiratory, but it affects every single major organ system in many ways. And you're dealing with patients who tend to be or tremendously at risk or older or have comorbidities in a wide variety of ways. And they are literally show up in the ICU where the physicians have no medical history on these patients, right? Incredibly, right, dangerous circumstance, not anything we would ever accept if it wasn't a pandemic, right? But that's because there's no interoperability in the system, right? Very, very hard. Federal government and then the ONC as implementers of the regulations, right, recognized years ago this was a real problem and we had to take care of it, but we didn't. And so lots of patients had bad experiences, had unnecessary treatment, had less than effective managing of their COVID illnesses, symptoms, or even post-acute follow-up, which is the next wave of things for us to worry about, because without interoperability, a lot of these patients are returning to their communities. And those records have to come back with them too for long-term, because we know that COVID has a dramatic potential, right, for long-term impact on what is now millions and millions of patients that have had it. So in many, many dimensions, right, it showed us how really unfortunately substandard, right, the system was on interoperability here. Relative to, I guess your specific question, well, what do we do about it as an industry? I think it absolutely increased the energy and the awareness around the need for interoperability, right? So we had a tremendous amount of kind of activity in 2020 of recognizing that and taking that small step just to say, we're moving this up on the priority list. I think, right, what's going on here towards the end of 2020 and into 2021, which I think is slightly concerning, right, for those of us that are highly focused on interoperability, is that the institutions, right, are trying to recover. They're rebuilding their patient panels. They're trying to rebuild their services, catch up with care that's in the past. And so I'm fearful, right, that we're starting to see a decrease in that intensity to recognize that there are technology solutions in place at many institutions, not just within my organization, but many others that can help you increase your interoperability. But the focus on, patients and volume and resetting practices and trying to think about, how they're kind of organized to deal with the new normal, right, pushes interoperability down a notch or two relative to where we're going. And I think that's a reflection, right, of our survey results that showed that while people know it has to be done and they might be working with their major vendors in one or two ways to make sure they're compliance, the great majority of people in these institutions are not focused on this at all. It's more back to business as usual or back to normal kind of practice with things that COVID has influenced and changed for sure. And I think that that is, may be unfortunate that the lesson that we should have learned and that was incredibly apparent to everyone in the industry, the intensity around solving that may have come down a few notches as we have now treatments and vaccines and other kinds of things in place, which is why I think the ONC, in many regards, right, said, we're not giving up on compliance here. We will enforce this. You're going to have to push this forward here. So that's what I think is the state of affairs relative to COVID-19 kind of impact today.
How can compliance with these new rules aid pandemic response measures?
I think, as I had described here, since the pandemic exposed, right, where interoperability causes patient harm, substandard care, redundant care, excessive cost, because I just don't have the medical information and history of these patients in order to treat them. But the inverse is, if we can get that, then I think as the foundation for these rule change or these purpose of these rules changes for the ONC is to, by accelerating access to this medical information, which is what they're trying to do here, then we will be able to more seamlessly, right, treat people with a higher quality of care. We'll be able to deploy more innovation. And so I would argue, right, that when we think about, God forbid, right, the end of this pandemic or future pandemics, with these rules in place, if the system allows significantly freer access to that data and patients have the ability to request it, own it, hold it, control it, frankly, put it into their own patient accounts so it's not held captive, right, by 27 different providers, but they get to centralize that here, then we'll be far better prepared, both as individual patients, but as a healthcare system to manage that next crisis, should or when, right, it evolves.
What can organizations do to better ensure that they are complying with the new rules?
So I would, based on the survey results we've done that show to us, right, that there is been inadequate education inside these institutions of the frontline staff that are dealing with patients here or provisioning, data, medical data to patients, there needs to be a more significant educational effort, right? And that education needs to include, right, an understanding of what patients' rights are, what these third parties have the right to do, and what the consequences to the institution are. Very hard to get people out of their cultural kind of place or their past practices of saying, my job is to protect the data, to hold it, and only give you the minimum amount necessary. And I'm a busy person, so you may not have to get it today. You may have to wait. Back to my policy is it's 30 days, right? They have to recognize that mindset, and they have to train that mindset will get the institution in trouble, right? And it's still happening today. But education is, I think, totally within the control of these providers and something that they ultimately have to do. The second is they really should be bringing interoperability higher on their priority list. And it's very hard, right? When you're an institution and you're spending large degrees of money, right, on equipment, right, whether it's laboratory equipment or the big MRIs where you're spending massive amounts of money, right, or even your EHRs, right, the functionality and what that equipment can do for you, right, a new robot that lets you perform a surgery, right, that you couldn't perform otherwise, it's very, very appealing. It's a lot of clinical interest here. Sometimes folks don't ask that question and then say, but is it interoperable? Does that data move, right? It's not a criteria that's high enough on the priority list historically, right, for organizations to say, yeah, maybe a great new service. But if all it does is keep the data captive and put me out of compliance, right, I should find another robot that does the same thing, et cetera, and makes it more, you know, easier. I use that as just a kind of an example here for folks that aren't experts in the clinical equipment, but the reality is they have to move up to the top of the organization to procurement, to purchasing, to clinical kind of evaluation of technology that it meets these interoperability standards and does more over time, right? So education, change in the priorities, evaluation. And the third thing I would say is go back to your existing vendors and challenge them on interoperability, right? Many vendors, unfortunately, right, in the healthcare space have historically slow walked this. And if we talk about true interoperability, we've been talking about it as an industry for 30 years, but there are, you know, healthcare organizations, large and small, right, where their business models are built on keeping data captive and monetizing that data, right? And they slow walk it. They say one thing, they're practically doing another with their technology, and they're making these changes as incrementally as possible, right? I would suggest providers, you know, are become aware that that's what's going on, be realistic about it, and challenge their vendors to change their practices and make interoperability really a prime focus for them. Because again, if we have interoperability, like we have in every other, frankly, major, you know, industry here in this country around healthcare data, it will improve quality. It will improve people's ability to manage their own care. It will lower cost. It will drive innovation. It will create scientific and medical advances much faster than we have in the past. We know that. We see it in all industries. It's a very simple, I think unchallenged kind of concept. But, many forces in the industry, look shorter term than across the system here. So I would encourage the leadership, right, of healthcare organizations to, you know, become much more aware of this and to drive it as a core value of their organizations.
And lastly, do you have any concluding thoughts?
I'm very excited about what the OMC is doing here and what they've done. I think they've created this rule set here in an incredibly balanced and smart way. Balancing the needs of patients, the needs of cost, the needs of the system, and the needs of vendors in the space pretty appropriately here. So I'm very pleased. And I am hopeful, right, that over the course of this next, year to 2 years, they will put their money where their mouth is, so to speak, and use both the carrot and the stick, right, to make sure that the industry is aware of what needs to be done here and that they are properly incentivized and motivated to continue to do the right thing. I think enforcement will be very important, and a lack of enforcement will, unfortunately mean that the industry will slow down and, potentially, these rules die, a slow death here. And I think it's very important for us not to do that as an industry, here or as a society for basic public policy.
Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Databook. Make sure you follow us on Twitter, @ChiefHealthExec, and on LinkedIn and Facebook. Until next time, I'm your host, Skylar Jeremias.